are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Today's show is brought to you by the audiobook version of What Truth Sounds Like, written and narrated by Michael Eric Dyson. What Truth Sounds Like is a historic meeting between Robert F. Kennedy, and James Baldwin that transformed RFK's thinking about race, politics, and the African-American lived experience. Barack Obama stated that everybody who speaks after Michael Eric Dyson pales in comparison. Start listening now at macmillanaudio.com/whattruthsoundslike.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 18th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the 5-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alfredo Corchado, reporter for the Dallas Morning News and author of Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great American-Mexican Migration. Also on the program today, Republicans can't get their story straight on their policy of family separation at the border. And Republicans on Capitol Hill give up their assault on Medicare. For now, anyways. Meanwhile, Trump's federal hiring freeze is leading to more prison violence. Good news, naloxone is leading to fewer opioid deaths. Dramatic drops in fatalities in areas where naloxone has been rolled out. Meanwhile, former staffers claim that Scott Pruitt, the EPA chief, thought he was being appointed to dukehood. Supreme Court punts on its major gerrymandering cases. And among Republicans, Kim Jong-un is more popular than Nancy Pelosi. Not to mention, more Republicans than not favor the government's policy of family separation. Meanwhile, Colombia, right-wing populace elected. All this and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, the news very much so dominated by the reports of children being forcibly separated from their parents at the border, parents being lied to about where their children are going, being told that they're going to take a bath and then just disappearing. And there being no mechanism for these parents to be notified or reunited with their children. I mean, this is just aside from the horror of the policy. We're I think just at the beginning of seeing the horror of the execution of the policy, where we have parents who are unable to find their children because somebody forgot to, write in a form as to where the children are being sent. I mean, this is just, it's horrific. It's gaining wider awareness. And, you know, some of the stuff that we have to put up with is the desperate attempts of different outlets to pretend that there's some dissent, really, in the Republican Party about this, some meaningful dissent. A New York Times piece, leading Republicans join Democrats in pushing Trump to halt family separations. You just sit with that headline for a moment and assess what it means to you. Because when I hear leading Republicans join Democrats in pushing Trump to halt family separations, I think Republican leaders. I think, oh my God, Paul Ryan, who has the ability to end this tomorrow by bringing legislation up that could get 300 or 400 votes if he wanted to. Or Mitch McConnell. Or maybe some top senators are out there saying, I'm not going to show up at work. I'm not going to vote on confirming a single one of Trump's nominees for anything until this is resolved. That's what you would think if you saw leading Republicans. But it turns out Melania Trump said she wrote a letter saying, I don't like this. I hope people from both aisles can deal with it. Laura Bush wrote a strongly worded letter against it. Laura Bush, do you remember who she is? Because she wasn't even first lady in the past 9 years. But apparently she's a leading Republican. I don't know when she was public last. And I will say, good, I'm glad Laura Bush did this. But it literally is riskier for me to come out against this than it is for Laura Bush. And I got news for you. It's not risky for me to do it at all. Laura Bush is putting zero on the line, ladies and gentlemen. Zero. In fact, when she comes out against this, it just means she has to sign off on the op-ed her speechwriter wrote.
I don't know. It's really going to piss off her constituents.
Right, exactly. All those folks who are going out and not having to vote, not having to buy her book. I mean, it's really just, I guess, around the house. I mean, and the idea that this is the leading Republicans. Oh, Senator Susan Collins deplored separations on Sunday. She deplored it. And then she went out. Oh, and let me tell you what the value of a Republican senator deploring something and then doing nothing else is. Zero. It is the value of me deploring it. In fact, it's even less than the value of me deploring it because the people I deplore it, express my deploration to, are going to act on it. All she's doing is positioning herself maybe to get elected. If anything, it's just an escape. It lets a little air out of the tires. So it's BS. And when the New York Times writes, leading Republicans join Democrats in pushing Trump to halt family separation, three people, one who's elected and doing nothing about it, is not leading Republicans doing anything. It is, where are the Republicans on this? They're nowhere. And this is a pretty low bar. I mean, this is a really low bar. Here are some protesters who interrupt another leading Republican, Vice President Mike Pence, who is the vice president of these fascist tactics that are being employed, and promoting the tax cuts to put America first. He gets interrupted on multiple occasions. And the Republicans in this audience, they're having none of it. 46% of Republicans, 37%, according to polls, support this family separation. And it'll get more. There's no reason to believe that it's going to change. Let's listen to this. This is in Columbus, Ohio.
With so many great Buckeyes on this Friday afternoon at the end of another extraordinary week for
children
America.
Are being locked up.
You know, the truth is,
boo, we're talking about tax cuts.
Yeah.
USA?
Of course. It's Chant USA. Remind people who's separating these children, locking them up in prisons.
Including our historic tax cuts. Let's hear it for America First policies that brought all of us here together today.
Uh-huh.
But I'm here today.
Look at this hippie radical wearing golf pants and a golf shirt, having to remind people that
first and foremost, to say thank you.
They're engaged in separating children from their parents. It's just disgusting. It really is disgusting. And it's incredibly, it's very frustrating. And there's no reason to believe that this isn't exactly, you know, what the Stephen Millers in the White House want. They want to agitate the libtards. And then the big upgrade is going to be that we're not housing children in cages. That's going to be the big concession. That's going to be the big compromise. There are two bills coming up. And make no mistake about this. I mean, right? Like, you know, it's almost as if we just this same story gets played over and over and over again. What happened to the Republican Party? Where's my Republican Party? This is your Republican Party. They needed something like 22 Republicans out of 230 to push a discharge petition with all the Democrats to get a somewhat humane immigration bill to the floor. 22. They couldn't even get 22. I get news for you. That's who your Republican Party is. If you can't get 20, if you can't get less than 10% of your caucus to act in a humane fashion, they're the bug. They're the bug. They're the anomaly. I saw somebody tweet out, like, you know, don't let the Republican Party become Donald Trump's party. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Unless you've got a time machine and can go back decades. John McCain in 2008 appoints Sarah Palin to be vice president. If he has his way, she would have been vice president for 8 years. Don't let the Republican Party be Donald Trump's party. The Republican Party was Donald Trump's party before he even announced. It just wasn't called Donald Trump's party because he wasn't a candidate yet. What a joke. Paul Ryan, I mean, this guy could end this tomorrow. Doesn't. Meanwhile, folks, if I have the opportunity to say this on television, I will be well shaven. Because Harry's founders knew that a great shave comes down to great blades made with sharp, durable steel that lasts. That's why they make some of the highest quality blades in the world, priced much lower than the leading brand. And they will give you a full refund if you don't love your shave. All you got to do is let them know within 30 days. Harry stands behind the quality of their blades, so they created a $13 trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave, weighted ergonomic handle. That's my favorite part. Five-blade razor with a lubricating strip and the trimmer blade. That's also important to me. Rich lathering shave gel, a travel blade cover. You can claim yours by going to harrys.com/majority report. You guys know this is my favorite razor. These guys have been very supportive of the show over the years. And it's the thing that makes my face look baby smooth when I show up on Hayes. That's where I'm down to. I'm like only shaved now for television. But the razors work. They do their job. And I'm not spending a Brinks car worth stuff at the pharmacy. Now our listeners can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/majority report. Make sure you go to harrys.com/majority report to redeem your offer. Let them know I sent you in support of this program. Hey, if you're like me, the list of books you want to read is never ending. My list just keeps getting longer and longer. I don't have time to read them all. I'm sure you're similar. Our sponsor, Blinkist, has solved your problem once and for all. Actually, both our problems. It's the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books, distills them down to their most impactful elements, so you can read or listen to them on your phone in under 15 minutes. You get all the action points, as they call it. I like to listen to Blinkist when I'm driving, walking to work. I do it. I can get sometimes two full books worth. Like blinks of a book, essentially, on my walk down here.
That's some Matt Leck shit right there.
It totally is. This would put Matt Leck out of business. The Blinkist library is massive. They got timeless classics like Think and Grow Rich, to current bestsellers like Fire and Fury. And there you go. My personal recommendation, all those, Tim Ferriss books.
Big Tim Ferriss fan.
That's, you know, I like his stuff.
Extra efficiently reading Tim Ferriss.
Yeah, I like that. That's a real double up there.
Isn't it?
An efficiency on the efficiency.
It's hyper concentrated.
It's like the 4 second.
I need another level of dilution.
That's right.
For the diluted nutrition of this material.
Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority. Start your free trial or get 3 months off your yearly plan when you join today. That's Blinkist, spelled Blinkist, Blinkist.com/majority. That's Blinkist.com/majority. Start your free trial or get your 3 months off your yearly plan today. Blinkist.com/majority. Lastly, whether you're like a health conscious person or, you know, sort of like a weekend warrior like myself, Liquid IV fuels tough workouts. I'm not really a weekend warrior. It's really actually during the week. Like Tuesdays is the day I get all my exercise. It's weird, but that's the way I do it. Helps prevent cramping, Liquid IV, fatigue, promotes healthy post-workout recovery. I'm also going to tell you, apparently it deals with jet lag, but for me, hangovers. Recover from a night out, fuels that fast-paced lifestyle I'm on. Quick hydration relief. Look, there are times I go out. I don't have, I don't drink like I used to. I don't, occasionally if I drink too much, I wake up in the morning. You know when I used this constantly was in Vegas. Because you're in those hotels, you get really dehydrated too. Liquid IV, it's a non-GMO electrolyte drink mix. It's vegan, free of gluten, dairy, and soy. Provides the same hydration as drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water, but it does it faster and more efficiently than water alone. And better yet, it contains 5 essential vitamins, including vitamin C and more than an orange, and as much potassium as a banana. You get a cold, you got to drink the heck out of this.
Nice.
Liquid IV donates 1 serving to people in need for every order placed. I love Liquid IV. I know you will too. Right now, my listeners get 20% off liquidiv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 20% off of anything, your order, on Liquid IV's website. That's liquid-iv.com. Liquid-iv.com. Enter my promo code MAJORITY. Get your savings. Start getting better hydration. That's liquid-iv.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Get hydrated today. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, Alfredo Corchado on his book, Homelands, 4 Friends, 2 Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. We'll be right back.
from a thought I had. Talking with Q in the back of a cab. Once we were lost and we never came back. I can only exist so long as you laugh. Don't give up on me if I ever leave town. Ain't it sad to see your life now work out? What made you think?
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program reporter, border reporter, Mexico reporter for the Dallas Morning News, and author of Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration, Alfredo Corchado. Alfredo, welcome to the program.
Sam, great to be with you.
All right, so let's there's a couple of things. I mean, obviously, there's almost two stories running through Homelands. One is your more personal experience, and the other is sort of a broader, more global experience of Mexicans and Mexicans in this country and Mexican Americans. Let's go back to the 86 Immigration Reform and Control Act, and give us a sense of what the implications of what that act was, but what the implications have been in terms of immigrants, Mexican immigrants in this country, and how it has shaped at least some percentage of the perspectives in this country today.
Well, the amnesty law passed by then President Ronald Reagan in 86 issued amnesty to something like 2.7 million immigrants, the majority of them being Mexicans. It was a situation where you had so much demand for labor, and you had so many undocumented immigrants throughout the country that the government, the Congress, was forced to react and do something. This is a period, Sam, that was called the Great Moderation, a period of robust economic growth that started in the 1980s and lasted something like 25 years. And even with Mexicans' labor force helping anchor this growth, the country could barely keep up with the economy. So all of a sudden, after 86, you had newly legalized immigrants spreading throughout the country. And suddenly you saw them in greater numbers in states like, say, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, and on and on and on. Historically, they had been sort of living in the southwest states, California, et cetera, but all of a sudden they just spread throughout the country. And I think many Americans started, you know, questioning what's happening to our country and what's happening to this nation.
There started to be genuine competition for jobs, or was it sort of perceived as some type of cultural infringement, do you think?
Well, I think both. I mean, I think people saw it as we need them, we need their help, we need their labor. But I think there's always historically there's been a fear of the unknown, and there were many people that I guess began to feel uncomfortable with the newcomers. But this is I'll give you a story. I was working. I arrived in Philadelphia in 87. I mean, Homelands is really the universal story of friendship and families. Arriving in Philadelphia, I believe at the time that I'm one of maybe one or two or four. It ended up being four Mexicans. And one of the towns that I discovered was through my reporting was Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, where this is known as the mushroom capital of the world. the Mexicans working there, mostly from the states of Guanajuato, back in Mexico, Michoacán, these are all central regions, were sort of in the margins, I mean, of society. I mean, they didn't mix, it didn't mingle with the general population. After IRCA, many of them decided to stay there. They liked the rural living. They liked living in Pennsylvania, and so their families came in. I mean, this reunification, the first reaction of the local population was to try to send them a message, you're not welcome. And then, this is back in the 1990s, people began to realize, the community began to realize, you know, we're living because of the mushroom industry. We need these workers. And so there was this sense of coexistence that began, to the point where I think today, Kenneth Square, Pennsylvania, is a model of how to get along and why the two sites need each other much more. I mean, in your description of the book, it's, yes, these are some powerful economic, cultural integration forces that have really reshaped both countries. We talk about Mexicans in the United States, but also a lot of Americans that are now living in Mexico. You hear Spanish in the United States. You hear a lot of English in Mexico. So it's this powerful integration that's taking place, the whole binationality of life.
Let's talk a little bit about NAFTA, 1994. What are the implications of NAFTA in terms of both the Mexican economy and then its subsequent impact on emigration, I should say, to the United States?
Well, there was a lot of reluctance on the part of Mexico, especially Mexican farmers who didn't believe they could compete with their U.S. counterparts. And as a result of NAFTA, you had millions of people who were forced out of the countryside. Many ended up migrating to the United States in search of jobs. It's interesting. I was just in central Mexico recently working on a poll for the Dallas Morning News. And this is 25 years after NAFTA. And people are still very ambivalent about the impact. I mean, was it good for them? I think the perception is that, I think it's a right perception that NAFTA was good for Mexico as a country, but not necessarily good for Mexicans in general. I mean, many of them, when you interview them, say, look, my wages haven't really changed in 25 years. The poll numbers show that something like 74 or over 70% of the people we interviewed said the situation is either worse or the same as it was during NAFTA. What it tells you is that you may know, your audience may know, Mexico has an election in about 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks, and you, for the first time, you may have a left-leaning, more populist government taking over the country. And those are signs that people are still not really happy with their economic situation. But in particularly security. I mean, security continues to be a big, big problem in Mexico.
Well, what does that mean that that NAFTA was good for Mexico but not for Mexicans? I mean, what does that mean? And I mean, it almost sounds like that's an invite for a left leaning government, frankly.
Well, I think it helped Mexico in the infrastructure. Throughout the country, really improve. I think in general, a lot more jobs, to the point where you have a million less Mexicans in the United States today. Even though the wages aren't great for a lot of Mexicans, they have options, they have choices. And many of the people we interviewed said, I don't know that I want to go to the United States these days. I mean, one, it's too dangerous to get across because of cartels, because of human smugglers. Too pricey, and it's you feel unwelcome in the United States because of the current government and the policies. So whether you agree with it or not, I mean, I think more and more Mexicans are thinking twice about coming to this country, and I think in that sense it's been good for Mexico that it's been able to sort of keep back its population. We also have to acknowledge that the Mexican demographics have changed a lot. I mean, families used to have 7 children per family, and now it's down to 2. So the numbers have also fallen. But I think when you ask him specifically, are you happier now? Man, so, you know, I don't necessarily want to go to the United States, but I think we do need to get better pay, better wages, obviously. But I mean, I've been covering this for almost 30 years now. It's the first time I see so many Mexicans saying, I don't really want to go to the United States. I mean, this is not the first choice. And for many years it was.
And is that a function of, I mean, you've mentioned that it's a big part of that is the danger in terms of going and that the reception when you get to the States. And is there more opportunity in Mexico? Have things sort of got to some type of equilibrium there?
There are more jobs. I think there are more jobs in Mexico. I think the price of smuggling, I mean, more jobs, not necessarily better paying jobs, but a lot more jobs. The price of smuggling, I mean, 25 years ago or so, smugglers were charging something like $700, $1,000 per person to come in from the border to, say, a city like Dallas, maybe $1,500 to a city like Philadelphia or New York City. These days, the prices have jumped to about 7,000, and now with the latest situation along the border with Central Americans, I mean, I've heard prices of, you know, smugglers are charging up to 10,000, even beyond, to try to get people across. So the situation has changed as far as who controls. I mean, who controls the border? It's largely now big, organized, transnational, organized criminal groups, where it used to be more of a, you know, the neighborhood, the community where you lived in, where you grew up in, you always knew who the local smuggler was, and you would negotiate with that person. Those days are gone. I mean, it's a very different situation. Mexico's coming out from one of its most violent years last year, and so every time you try to cross the border, it gets that much more dangerous. It's that much more more of a risk.
I mean, you would think that the increase in the violence would drive more people out of the country, but I guess maybe that increase in violence is happening closer to the border. Is that what you're saying? Or I mean, it's certainly
the violence.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say, I mean, for many years, the violence, the insecurity issues in Mexico were much more targeted along the border, along the northern part of the border. These days, it's being felt throughout the country, especially even, you know, in the prosperous regions of central Mexico. You see a lot more extortions, kidnappings. So that's has driven many Mexicans out, much more middle-class people who can find a way to get legal visas to come to this country. That doesn't compare necessarily to the situation in Central America, where the gangs, I mean, really do control neighborhoods, really do control small communities. It's bad as Mexico is. It hasn't reached the Central America level yet.
All right. So just lastly on that topic, when we talk about the danger and we talk about these international crime syndicates, are they driven by drugs? Is the crackdown on immigration in this country sort of building their operations? Is it both?
I think it's both. I mean, anytime you have a crackdown, a U.S. crackdown on immigration, the people who really profit from this are the smugglers. I mean, they love it when the U.S. government puts out a new policy because it means charging more money. And obviously the U.S. demand for drugs continues to motivate a lot of the cartels, despite legalization of marijuana. Mm. I mean, there's always something else, meth, heroin. There's always a new candy to go after. I mean, whatever the U.S. Demands, the Mexicans will criminal groups will find a way to get them across. But it's beyond drugs. I mean, drugs is a big factor. But it's also just controlling populations through extortions, through kidnappings. Again, you know, traveling to Central Mexico and trying to get a feel for what's going to happen in the upcoming elections, I was very surprised at the number of middle-class, prosperous Mexicans who've said, you know, I've had enough. I mean, the insecurity we were witnessing along the Mexican border, the northern border, has now reached into the interior of Mexico. Hmm.
I know that in the course of your reporting, you've just come back from Tornillo in Texas. What did you see there?
It was amazing. I mean, it was one of those stories that I think you will remember forever. I mean, Congressman Beto O'Rourke issued a call to action 24 hours earlier. This is on Saturday morning via tweet, and said, you know, let's march to Tornillo, where the white tent city is being set up. This is shelters to house the children, the minors. As many as 200 are being housed right now. The concerns are that as many as 4,000 may arrive in the next few days or next few weeks to come. But so I showed up thinking, you know, I don't know how many of you are going to show up. It's Sunday morning. It's the World Cup is playing. I mean, Mexico versus Germany is playing.
Father's
it's
going to
be a tough sell.
Right.
Father's Day was a big deal. But there were hundreds. I mean, some people have estimated, you know, more than 1,000, up to 2,000 people showed up. That was really interesting. But it was also people from all walks of life. I mean, people from not just from El Paso, from that region, but throughout Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah. Obviously, Congressman Joe Kennedy showed up from Massachusetts. And it was, it was a very passionate rally. I mean, the outreach is there. People are really, really insulted at how these policies really belittle many of the immigrants who are coming with to claim asylum. So it was interesting to see that kind of support in just a few hours of notice.
In your opinion, Alfredo, is the or based upon your reporting, can you give me an assessment of how it breaks down in terms of asylum seekers? I mean, my intuition tells me that the vast majority of these asylum seekers are non-Mexican, Central American folks coming from Guatemala or Nicaragua or Honduras, as opposed to Mexico. Is that the case, or what is the more or less the breakdown of folks looking for asylum and who are populating the children who are going to populate these internment camps, essentially?
Well, I mean, we're seeing asylum claims from people throughout the world, but mostly it is Central Americans. We are still seeing a lot of Mexicans coming from states that have been really ravaged by the violence. But the vast majority of the cases that I've seen, that I've reported on, are people coming from Honduras, coming from Guatemala, people who've been forced by cartels, by gang violence, cartels that are still sort of responding to the demand in the United States for drugs. You still have the remnants of the U.S.-led conflicts in Central America of the 80s, and the corruption that you have with past and current administrations. So all that has are the push factors that are leading people to the border to seek asylum. It was interesting. I was walking the port of entry in El Paso just in late May, when I started seeing the customs officials, you know, sort of at the entrance of the, I mean, when you walk into the United States from Mexico, you have to go through customs. That's obvious. But you saw a second unit of people of agents looking for others. And at the time, I thought, you know, this is kind of unusual. But later we found out they're looking for Central Americans, and to try to tell them, you know, it's a full house today, we can't take you in, and then they send it back. So obviously it's led to, it's part of the whole family separation policy by the Trump administration. The concern is that it's leading to a chaotic situation where you might need a lot more white tents in the weeks to come. This is just the beginning of June, and that's usually when you start seeing the rise of immigrants coming more and more. I mean, springtime, summertime.
So, all right, you said this is a, and I know you've got to go in a minute or two here, but you said that there's a push dynamic here, that people are trying to escape violence in their home countries. Do you have a sense of the calculation? Does the calculation to leave still make sense to these folks, even though they may be starting to hear stories of these type of horror stories? Are they just going to prepare themselves? Is their situation in their home states bad enough that they're still going to risk it going forward?
The people we interviewed, I've been on the border in Guatemala and Mexico, and you tell them what's going on in the United States, I don't think they really believe you. I mean, these are people who are making a 2,000-mile trek, and all they think about is a new life, a new beginning, a new opportunity. They're not scrolling down the phones or checking on the latest news, but they do hear that something is happening. It's not until they get to the border and they realize that, you know, they may be separated, but I think many mothers question the sacrifice they made to try to get their kids out. But the situation, I mean, when you ask them, they say, look, I know here you might be going through a hard time, it might be difficult, but you have a chance of at least living. Where in Central America, there's a greater odds that you will be killed by drug violence or by gang violence.
Alfredo Corchado, the book is Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. I wish we had a little more time to talk, but I appreciate your coming on. It's a fascinating story, and you have great insight, obviously. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks, I'm going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. We're going to talk more about this story. It is... it's really incredibly disturbing to have such a naked policy meant to create such human suffering. And that's basically what it is. I mean, there's no other potential outcomes here. It's just we have a policy that the construction of which is if we can create enough human suffering, we can make sure that there are less white people who are entering in our country. Fourth of July coming up. God bless America. Folks, a reminder, this program relies on its members to continue. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you become a member, we give you access to the fun half. You get a lot more content if you want. You also get the show commercial free. So if you get annoyed at days when we have multiple commercial ads, you can get rid of those as well. And you also ensure that the program shows up every day. I tell people sometimes I do a podcast. They're like, well, what days do you do it? Well, we put it out every day.
4 days, and then one day I'm not here, but that's it's still right. 5 days.
That's right.
So many days.
So many days.
All you do is take and take and take. And
well, I don't say that to the people who are asking me the question.
As soon as you join, if you don't become a member, you're a taker. Thank you. Can at least they buy
say,
me a
they
drink.
Say, they say,
you
can
at least
can
buy
I listen
me a
to
drink.
The show? Sure, if you want to take.
Sure, if you want to take. You want to be a non-contributing member of the community.
I found that's a very, very slow way to build an audience.
Why don't you just listen to Pod Save America?
I always thought it was weird.
Leave me alone.
I thought it was weird in the interview when Sam referred to downloading as take loading.
Take loading?
The taker culture.
Also, don't forget, you can sign up to TMBS. They just do it one day a week.
It's 4 days a week for patrons. In fact,
it's 4 days.
4 days for patrons.
We record it all in one day.
That's not technically true. You didn't even get me on a technicality.
It's not true.
It's not true. It's wrong. Fake news.
Matt is recording it all week.
There's one that Matt doesn't record because he's a bastard. All that's right. A whole other one.
The Michael Brooks Show, you can get it on iTunes, or you can subscribe on iTunes. Subscribe. You can also check it out on our YouTube page. Tomorrow is Tuesday. Do you know who's going to be on yet?
Bhaskar Sunkara from the Jacobin magazine and rapper and writer Will EQ.
Will EQ will be on tomorrow. Also, don't forget, you can hear the Antifada, Jamie's co-hosted podcast at patreon.com/Antifada or on iTunes this week.
This week, we just recorded an episode yesterday. It might even turn into a double episode because we recorded so much stuff. I had my DSA comrade, Justin Charles, from the North Brooklyn branch, and we talked about identity politics, organizing, race, gender. We dragged on Elon Musk a bit. It was super fun.
Elon Musk did not actually show up for the show.
I guess you'll have to listen to it.
Well, he said he
is
a socialist, so
there you go.
Yeah, Elon Musk's going to be on my show. Elon Musk will be on in July on TMBS.
That's not
we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about socialist
Matt dropped another episode of Literary Hangover on Saturday, correct?
Yep, Rip Van Winkle, brand new episode. Don't sleep on that.
Ooh.
You've been waiting for a long time. All right, folks. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Quick break, head into the fun half. 646-257-3920.